You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One, this time live with writer-director Adam Agoyan. Agoyan's latest film is called Guest of Honor and follows the story of Veronica, a young woman who has recently gotten out of prison and her complicated history with her father, Jim. In this one-on-one, we get to speak to Agoyan about walking a tightrope between justice and grace, refracted lenses that poison relationships, and freedom from our own personal prisons. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Hi, thank you so much for calling me. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
I loved Guest of Honor. I thought it was wonderful.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Where'd the story come from?
Well, I mean, it came from the fact that our son was working as a busboy in this very exclusive French restaurant in Toronto, and came back with stories of the chef, who is the proprietor, also being tormented by a food inspector who is making his life really difficult. And the character began to emerge, and I began to think of parenting and how much do we really know about our kids. And the story began to take hold of a trap that a father and daughter had put themselves into, where something had happened in the daughter's life at a certain age that needed explanations, and you know, the father could not tell her what had happened because it wouldn't have made sense at that point to tell a 9-year-old girl the full details of what had happened. And then I began to think, well, and by the time he could tell her, maybe she wouldn't believe him because the two people that were involved in this incident were no longer there. So that became sort of the root of the story, like that weird place where we all know that in a family or any relationship, you need to have openness, there has to be communication, but where there couldn't be communication, and where that blockage had this really strong effect on the two characters. So that's where it came from. Of course, there's all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of issues around, you know, Me Too and this idea of, you know, the ways in which lines were being crossed. And I thought that she was also, as a teacher who had these responsibilities, there was something very interesting about this choice that she made. But she's a very extreme character, and she obviously has this very self-destructive sort of tendency. Mm. But that's where it came from. Yeah. And of course, you know, having worked in restaurants, and you know, I had a club, a small bar on Queen Street called Camera, and we had to deal with food inspectors, and I just, you know, you become aware of this whole network of how this city especially is built up on this network of restaurants and all these different sort of windows into these different places. And so this person who spends his day going from, you know, one place to another, and who himself was a restaurateur at one point, that became really interesting and rich in possibility.
Mm. Yeah, he's a fascinating character, and David Thewlis is just wonderful in the role of Jim. And, you know, I was wondering what it is about David that you felt was he was going to be your Jim for the role?
Well, there are actors that, you know, you see a performance and you just never let it go. I mean, I'd seen David in Naked, Mike Lee's film, like a long time ago, but just the way he was able to hold the screen and the energy he had, and I just thought it'd be very interesting to revisit this person, you know, this actor, like all these years later. I mean, I'd seen him in several films, but I'd never seen him just, you know, take on a lead role, and I just prayed that he would respond to the script when I sent it to him, and he did. So that was really, you know, we met and had this wonderful conversation, and I just was so thankful that I found my actor. And he was so curious, and he brought so much to the role. And some of my favorite scenes are the ones where he's not doing anything, where he's just opening a drawer and looking at ribbons and looking at an old cell phone. And we read everything in his performance.
Yeah, he really carries it. When he's on the screen, you're just transfixed by him.
Oh, great. Thank you.
And the one thing I loved about his character is that he seems to walk a very thin tightrope between justice and grace. You know, here's a guy with a stroke of a pen can destroy a restaurateur, but at the same time he's begging for his daughter to be free. I was wondering...
Yeah, I mean, that's a lovely observation. And I think that But she doesn't want to be, you know, and the question is, you know, like, is she deriving some sort of a therapeutic kind of, you know, by seeing her father in that state, by these visits, you know, is she almost in a very strange, perverse way taking something from that? Is that does she actually also want to punish him as well?
Right.
Because he goes on about reputation and, you know, how he knows how important it is to, you know, preserve a reputation. But of course, his reputation has been demolished by this action. And, you know, there's a side of what she does, which I think is really also focused on seeing him pay this penance as well. And it's so unfair, because ultimately, if they had only communicated to each other, this might have been avoided. But I also understand that wouldn't have been possible. Like I said, there's no way he would have told her at that time that, you know, that her idolized, you know, music teacher, you know, that they were having an affair, but the mother was aware of that because she was ill and, you know, was thinking of maybe a mother figure for her daughter, right? You know, a nurturing figure. So it's a real tragedy, really, at the core of this. But he can't explain that to her. And as I said, by the time he could, when she was older, she probably locked herself into such a place that she wouldn't believe it, right? She would have said, well, that's just, you know, that's easy for you to say now, but, you know, that... You know, and I think that really hurts him as well, that he feels that he doesn't have that trust from her. But, you know, what has he done to earn that at the same time, right?
Well, yeah, and I mean, with Veronica, like, she's in prison, but she's also in a personal prison. Like, she's put herself in this unique space.
She feels responsible for wiping out this family, right?
Sure. I mean,
between the mother and the son. That's where she is.
Yeah. What do you think that her character needs to be set free?
I think her character needs to know that, in fact, exactly what the priest tells her, right? That in fact, that the mother had given her blessing for that relationship, and that was something that the mother felt would be, you know, best for her to have this woman that was in her life then take on that maternal role. And I think the most moving part of the film for me, which is very buried, and I don't expect people to understand it, but at the end, when Jim is doing his final inspection, and there's that close-up of that smile on his face when he comes to realize something, I think that's the moment where he thinks that if he has his funeral at that church, that maybe that conversation might happen, that maybe the priest would actually offer that information, because that's the only person who can. It's the only person who objectively would be able to say that and allow Veronica to believe it. You know, because I think it's, you know, I'm realizing something speaking to you too. Not only is it that Veronica wouldn't believe the father, but also what would be the point in the father telling her that history? Because the music teacher, Alicia, isn't there either. So why would he tell her that? You know, that this was something that had been worked out. There's no point. He doesn't see any point to it. And yet, it's a moment that actually would have a profound benefit. But there's no one there, and I think this happens sometimes, there's no one there to regulate that. There's no one there to kind of say, this would be the best course of action. And so these two characters are left on their own devices, to their own devices.
I love that you brought up the church. And, I mean, Father Greg is such a fascinating character. Luke is wonderful in this role. He's so good. But I think it's interesting because in a case of Jim and Veronica, I mean, Jim isn't a character who seems to consider himself religious, but there's so much religious imagery within the film.
But there's one clue. There's one huge clue, which is that when he's at the party, at the Armenian restaurant,
the communion scene,
he holds up a glass and he says, to his blood, right? Yeah. And that is it. That is a moment from the Eucharist. That is like a moment of communion. So my suspicion is that there was religion in his background, but he just hasn't been following it. And so he does create all of these weird sacraments, like look what he's doing with the rabbit, and look what he's doing with all that stuff. Like, it's as though he still needs that, but it's not. Since there's no institutionalized, we also understand that, his wife Rosangela's parents gave a lot to the church, right? At one point, you know, she says that. So, yeah, I think it was there. It's just that, you know, he's lapsed. It's not there in his life anymore.
You know, that makes sense. Yeah, and I love that. I'm glad you brought it up, because I remember as I was watching the film, I sat there and I went, wait a minute. He actually just conducted a Eucharist. Wait a second. What just happened here?
But again, it's not, it's just subtle, right? It's like, it's just a thing that's said in it, but it's a clue. I think that that's, you know, it's there.
I see what you're saying.
But I think, you know, Father Greg, you know, like, the, you know, there's two things he breaks. One is he, you know, he breaks the code of confession, because he tells, you know, him, he tells her what Alicia said. But also, you know, he inserts these, you know, very, very pagan sort of, like, ritualized, you know, objects into the coffin, right? You know, which is really odd for a Catholic priest to do. And it almost looks like he's going out like an Egyptian pharaoh, right, holding these two rabbit feet.
That's true. You know, one of the things I thought was interesting about the film is how it plays with time. Like, it feels chronological, but it's mostly in flashback. I was wondering what it is about this style that you felt would bring out the best in your story.
Well, because it's all about these conflicting, you know, images that are existing in these two characters' minds, right? Mm. Like, they both have these memories, they both have these sort of images of things that happened, and, you know, those are being revisited over the course of the film. So there had to be a structure that allowed that to happen fluidly. And so there's five timelines that are being kind of followed. And you could say that they're, you know, that sounds confusing, but I think as you watch the film, it's not. I think it's pretty clear. But, you know, between her as an 8-year-old, her as a 17-year-old, right, her as a, you know, on the school band trip, her in jail, and her, you know, with the priest. I mean, those are five different sort of moments that are being referred to. So to get that and to keep it fluid and to keep all those balls, you know, bouncing, the structure seemed most organic.
I was wondering, too, about glass.
Oh, thank you. First person.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah. It's a key thing.
First person. Okay, great. Thank you.
Can you talk about that imagery in the film? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's just glass is the thing. First of all, we're telling our story through glass, camera lenses, you know. But also, glass is this object which refracts and kind of, like, you know, in this case, creates different sounds, but also, you know, is able to create these strange distortions, right? You know, in the film, there are flares, you know, but, you know, there's this idea that glass, and it's also fragile, it can break, you know, so all those things were really important in the visual motif of the film, and thank you for bringing it up.
So much of the film is taught, is about perspective as well, and I see that with the glass imagery, but I was wondering if perspective, I guess maybe we've already spoken about this a little bit, perspective really can poison relationships, because I see so much division based on people's misunderstandings.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, of course. And the question is, like, you know, who determines what actually is the story that's told, and why is that story being told? And, you know, this is a very unusual situation where she is perceiving something as a child, and what she's perceiving is that the father is doing something so incomprehensibly wrong. Mm. And we need to understand that. But we need also, so, and I think it's all told in that moment where there's we see an image twice. Once she's writing these notes at a piano and sees her, she's playing the piano, and she notices her father make a signal to the music teacher that they go upstairs. And it just seems like so cavalier and crazy. But then when we see it again after she understands, you know, what has happened to the father, we see that he's actually in the same place, but his head is in his hands, and he just leaves the room, and the teacher goes to follow him to try and comfort him. And it's interesting that the only thing that separates those two scenes is the fact that she now has the information from Father Greg as to what the circumstance really was. But if there's no one there to tell you that, then there's no reason for her to have ever altered that. And I firmly believe that even if the father had told her that story, like, you know, which he wouldn't have, because, you know, there would be no point to it from his perspective. He doesn't understand that she's in pain because of that. So why would he tell her?
I would like to ask you about the rabbit. and ask you sort of what drew you to that specific imagery in the film.
The fact that I had rabbits from a very young age, the fact that I took my rabbits to pet shows, the fact that they won those ribbons, the ribbons that you see in the film are ribbons that my rabbit actually, my various rabbits won. So I, and the fact that, you know, rabbits can live that long. I mean, it's unusual, but they can. So, and you just, and there's something mysterious about rabbits, right? There is something mysterious about the rabbit feet. There's mysterious, you know, like no one can tell you the real reason why rabbit feet were considered to be lucky. Like there's so many conflicting views about that. So it just felt like an interesting pet.
Yeah, it's such an interesting relationship there with the legs, and he strokes it. He almost looks like a Bond villain, but I mean,
yeah,
just the way he cares for the rabbit, you know what I mean? But anyway,
it's sort of like Austin Powell, with the hairless dog.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Evil. There is a comparison I hadn't made, but yes, I guess it does. Oh, Adam, I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this interview, and thank you for bringing up the glass issue. God, you work so hard on something, and it's just shocking how. Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad it reached somebody. That's okay. Thank
well, you. I appreciate it. It's a wonderful
okay.
film. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye, Steve. Thank you. Bye.